about the relationship between art and political struggle. Mm. Since all of your writing, all of your poetry, and all of your art that I've encountered has had has been steeped in a tradition of struggle, and it talks about conditions like that.
Well, I guess I would put it this way. To me, the revolutionary style, the style of somebody who is very active in change, I think is to be an artist and a scientist at the same time. And what I mean by that is that you have to have some kind of firm foundation, which comes from knowing the world you're in. It comes from knowing the society, the different classes, the different historical, you know, developments, but at the same time being very creative as far as forms, knowing how to shape your life around you, knowing how to connect with people and the various things that they bring to it. And that's a very hard thing to do, but I think that's what's important. Art to me is the part of us as human beings that will allow us to actually change, because some of what we do can't change, you know, but there's a part of us that's so creative. So any issue, any problems, you tap into that creative reservoir that every human being has, you can begin to deal with them, you can resolve them. And I think that this is something where the art comes in. Everybody's got to find their particular art and connect it to social change, social struggle, the way that we need to do it today.
In the poor neighborhoods, you see a lot of graffiti. You see whole genres of music like hip hop and rap, you know, that have come out of cultures of poverty. What role does creative self-expression play in the definitions of culture in those areas?
Well, I think those are the examples that, no matter the fact that you don't have commercial connections, that you're not on TV, you're not in the movies, you still create art. And poor people create art all the time, and it goes as far back as anybody could ever record. Those examples of hip-hop coming out of the basements of some Bronx ghetto, you know, there was no education, no resources, but yet they were able to create even a language art. To me is and dance and graffiti, but language too. It's like, you know, those arts are insistent. They don't die out. Now what happens though is if you're poor, sometimes the arts is how you express your story, you express your struggle, you express where you think you have to go. And I think to a certain point, hip-hop represented that. The only problem is that when it got commercialized, a lot of that part was taken out. And that's what we're seeing today. I think a very commercialized, apolitical type art.
In your book, Always Running, Living La Vida Loca, you describe some very harsh circumstances under which you grew up. And I think that, you know, we've seen a continuation of those kinds of circumstances today. I mean, youths of today repeat them all the time. Here in Columbus, Ohio, we have a number of gangs, and by all accounts, the gang activity and the abundance of gangs is on the increase, as well as the level of violence and drug usage and that sort of thing. But it doesn't have a long history in Columbus. It's just starting. A lot of the gang members here in Columbus, from what I understand, are not as hardened, not as committed as people from places like Chicago and East LA and New York. How would you suggest a city like Columbus approach the whole situation? You know, how do we somehow make things turn out a little differently here than they have elsewhere?
Well, if possible, the idea is to have a whole community approach. And what I mean by that is that you have to have all the factors that bring a young kid to want to be a gang, you got to have addressed. There's psychological factors, there's social, there's economic, there's cultural, there's spiritual. All these factors have to be addressed in a wholesome way. When you bring in the family, you bring in the members of the community, you have dialogue, you learn to organize, you learn to bring in resources. If you involve the young people, which is fundamental, they actually learn how to be responsible, because then they take care of what they build. They learn to have trust with adults, which most of the time they don't. I mean, when you see gangs, you're basically seeing the same problem everywhere. There's no connection with adults. There's no economic means. There's very little to do. You know what I mean? You gangs flourish in the same conditions. And I think that when you address those conditions, especially if you address them in a very vibrant, dynamic way, you're not going to see the same level of gang activity. And I think Columbus, like most cities that are beginning, they have an opportunity to do that, unlike some of the bigger cities that already have entrenched gangs.
So for activists in the, I don't want to say affluent, but, you know, communities like the one that surrounds us here in Clintonville, some of the other more stable, more balanced neighborhoods, less impoverished. How do activists coming from that kind of strata begin to address the problem? I mean, how do we reach the youth that are at risk?
Well, some of them, I think, have access to resources that other people don't have. They have some intellectual knowledge that a lot of people can't get. I think that it's just a matter of them bringing to bear what they know. It's not about them coming into a poor community and as you know, take it over or lead it or you know, reshape it. What it is those communities just need what they have, what they know. We need people who have some influence and some connections, because poor communities just don't have those things. We need them to come in and very generously, but also for the long haul, help those communities reconnect. For example, the media. How do we create media in these poor communities where they have their own radio stations, their own TV stations, their own film production groups, documentary groups, where they can tell their story through books, publishing? There's so many things that are missing. And whereas affluent communities have levels of these things, if people can come in and help bring in some of that knowledge, bring in some of those resources, I think it would help the poor communities get trained, organized, and then get them to find their own resources. To me, there is connections that could be made if they come in with the right, respectful, meaningful way that they should come in, versus somebody just coming in and says, well, we're going to show you how to do it, and that's it.
I guess that question is sort of dependent on an artificial differentiation between various communities, you know, one community versus another, but there are no specific boundaries. What about the definition of community as a whole? Aren't we all part of the equation, whether we participate actively or not?
Well, yeah, I think community, there's an organic thing that makes community. Sometimes community is conflictual. Sometimes we don't think we're in a community, and we are. It's all part of it. But I think that there has to be some essential agreements that people have to make within those communities that says this is a community. Those agreements, for the most part, should be what are essential for everybody. For example, there should be an agreement in every community that we should make sure that every child is taken care of, that their health, their physical health, spiritual health, and you know, psychological health is taken care of and insured. That's just one agreement, but can you imagine if we had that agreement? It didn't matter if you had different people with different languages, different cultural backgrounds, or any of that. They would all work together to make sure that every child had that. See, and I think community misses those agreements, those social contracts that used to exist. Right now, we're just creating communities because people just live in the same neighborhood. And sometimes they don't even talk to each other, and they don't even know that they're going through similar things, or they don't even get along. And I think that that's what we're calling community now, and it's not really the only essential things we bring in, possibly sometimes is power and light and pick up the trash. But I think there's more to it. And I think that if communities could sit down and dialogue and discuss and find what those essential things and expand them, they would find that they could have agreement and they could get along with the various differences they bring into it, but they could ensure that the well-being of their community is overall paramount regardless of where they come from.
Where we left off, we were talking about definitions of community and impediments to reaching across cultural and class barriers and that sort of thing. You were saying that language was one of the critical barriers. You want to elaborate on that?
I think the idea is that language has to be respected. I think we have this idea that we're going to have one language, we're going to homogenize everybody. And I think that's what's wrong. The country is so full of different cultural expressions, so many languages. And I think the idea is that you can have a common language. And English is fine. It could be anything. But English is good because historically that's the language that we have. But that people could also learn and keep Spanish or Chinese or Japanese or any other language you might have. And I use the example of Europe because all over Europe people speak two or three languages. They teach them when they're young. Nobody complains. It's not a big deal. Only in the United States do we see this big problem that all of a sudden language becomes a barrier. Instead of, it shouldn't be a barrier, it should actually be a way that people get over. If you're good at Spanish, for example, that should be the basis to be good at other things. But it becomes an impediment, and it shouldn't. If you already have that knowledge, you can learn English and you can also develop. And I think we just have to see language and just look at it differently, the respect for each other's languages.
What about cultural heritage and cultural pride? For people in the dominant culture, oftentimes witnessing expressions of cultural pride from the immigrant groups and from so-called minorities is perceived as sort of a threat, you know, that they find that threatening. And yet to assert one's culture in a situation where there is oppression, where there is discrimination, is also an act of defiance. So you can sort of see where some of that notion of a threat comes from. How do we create conditions in which everyone's culture can be celebrated and acknowledged and embraced without there being friction?
Well, one is to accept that to be human is to be particular, and every particular way of doing it should be acknowledged and understood. I mean, I know there's people say, well, I only see human beings and I don't recognize anybody's race. Well, I think that doesn't work. You have to recognize their race. You have to recognize their culture. I think people want to be validated. They want to know that wherever they come from, it's just as good as where anybody else is coming from. This concept, though, is that basically there's levels of validation. And if, let's say, whatever they call Anglo, which is a misnomer anyway, but that's the top. And then you go on down and say, well, that's not right. What kind of society is it where you have these levels, and you have to try to move yourself up them? So the more Anglo you are, the more you're accepted. To me, that's really destructive of people's cultures. It hurts people. A lot of people, I think, even join gangs because they can't participate at that way of being accepted, and they try to find other acceptable groupings. So I think the key thing is to respect everybody. Again, we have some essential community issues we can address. We can have a common language. But I think when you unite around these essentials, one of the essentials should be that people should have the liberty and freedom to be who they are and to be acknowledged and respected for who they are.
And what about the role of dialogue? When you set up a dialogue between people who are perceived as coming from different spheres, how do you create an atmosphere of parity so that dialogue takes place among people who are presumed to be equals rather than people who are presumed first to be different?
Well, this is a hard one because I think the dialogue has to be very hard. I know people think that conflict resolution is just get people together and don't raise the hard issues and we'll all be happy. I think we need a dialogue to raise the hard issues, to raise the issues of the inequities in this country, to raise the slavery issue, to raise the fact that the Indian peoples were killed and driven off, to raise the owning of the conquering half of Mexico. You know what I mean? To raise these hard issues, not to put white people down, not to make anybody feel bad. It's just because you can't really heal unless you go through those wounds. And the problem is we have so many wounds in this country that nobody wants to go there. We want to just deny it, liberate it, and pretend we can just go into the future without having to address those things. And I think that's why it's hard to go into the future, because they pop up, the rage keeps coming up. And I think we have to go through this real hard rage. But the way we have to do it, though, is like those tribunals of reconciliation you see in South Africa, some of these places where people are just pouring out and people are listening, and you pour out all the things that you can remember about the hatred, the discrimination, the painful experiences, and have other people do it too. It's not like it's just against white people. It really is to bring out all this inequity so that we know as a country we have gotten a certain place at the expense of a lot of people. And you shouldn't forever forget that. We're not the most powerful country in the world just because we're freedom-loving, nice people. It's not the history. But I think it's important to bring it up so that we can say, where do we go from here? Do we stay in power, or do we become a country in which people can feel their trueness and feel connected and feel that they are part of the world community instead of isolated and alone and afraid in the world, which is what we've been coming.
I've noticed a lot of unconscious arrogance. I was in Arizona recently and I spoke with a high school student there who's Caucasian, and he said that the Mexican students at his school hate him. Apparently they've yelled at him, they've spit on him, etc. And he said that they hate him because they are inferior, and that as the evidence that they are inferior is that, you know, his ancestors were able to conquer this country. You know, that if the Mexicans had been a greater, more accomplished people, they would have defended the land more valiantly. And he did not realize the arrogance of what he was saying.
Well, yeah. Especially because it's not even based true in history. I mean, the indigenous people in this continent fought every way they could against the oppression that came down. Most of them got killed by the diseases that nobody even realized was going to do it. But even then, the level that the Spanish and eventually the English and French and other people that came here, the level of massacres and destruction got worse and worse because people fought back. There was that Red Stick Rebellion in the south of the Creek Indians that they actually went out, and some of them were African-American slaves, and they went out and killed some white people, and they were going to defend themselves. Well, when the whites got to them, they just killed every man, woman, and child. because that's the way they had to respond. To me, it isn't a matter of white people being superior. They were more willing to destroy whatever was possible. Like, there's figures that say that about 50 years as the Europeans came to the Americas, 95% in some areas were completely destroyed of these people. So you're not talking about people who didn't want to defend themselves. In fact, the Aztecs defended themselves. People always got that all wrong. They always think, well, they didn't. They defended themselves very bravely, but they did it against cannon, and they did it against horses, and they did it against guns that they couldn't exist. They did it against other Indian tribes that were actually pulled into by the Spanish. And there was a lot of things that happened. And then when the Spanish finally took the city, what the Spanish did is destroyed every ounce of that city, every bit of it. This is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It rivaled any city. It was bigger than any cities in Spain. It was cleaner. It was more organized. They had 60,000 books in the temples. They burned everything. What is that? If that what makes white people superior, then I think white people would have to question. Of course, they should question it, because that's nothing to do with being white. It has to do with the fact that history worked out that way, where these people came in there not for God. They were looking for gold. And they needed that gold, and that gold became valuable. In fact, the whole European advancement, capitalism, was created when the gold opened up in the Americas and the slavery trade opened up in Africa and other places. And then you realize that all this power and all this empire and all this greatness that supposedly some of these people have was on the backs of intense, brutal slavery, intense, brutal destruction of peoples and lands, taking over of lands. I always tell people the United States had two great freedoms. The freedom of land. They took whatever land they could. I mean, if anybody had that, they'd all be great. And also, they had free labor. For 400 years, they had free labor. So it's like, can you expect you not to be superior in that sense, that you actually are over the people? So I think people have to know what the history is. And yet people always defended themselves. Slaves weren't just a bunch of petty people that just went along. There was rebellions right and left. And overall, as you think about it, those things got changed. Those things got struggled. The African-American community is still here. The Mexican community is still here. So in spite of all the cold oppressions, we're still very strong. We're still able to stand up. We're not even hateful. I don't think anyone is saying, just get rid of all white people. I don't think anyone, I don't know, maybe some people are, but most people aren't. Most people are saying, just don't take my dignity away. Just don't take my validation away. You should have whatever you have, and we can work together. That's our position. It's not even a bad one. And if people want to challenge the superiority of simple people's ideas, I will challenge that that's a more superior one, that we can all live together, have something in common, and make sure that everybody's well-being is ensured.
Well, there are two ways I want to go with this. First of all, the reason I brought up the fellow in Arizona and talking about the Mexicans that he said didn't like him there in his high school is that he is also in the ROTC in his high school. And he doesn't really see anything wrong with U.S. foreign policy at any point in history. Not that he necessarily knows very much about it. And most high school students don't, really. But, for instance, the current policy in Iraq, he thinks that that's perfectly justified. But here we're talking about creating community and celebrating differences and learning to live cooperatively and, you know, address grievances in a civil manner. How does that extend to foreign policy, and can we do that in an isolated way when the foreign policy contradicts those very values?
Well, I think that's the idea. We can't be hypocrites. We can't talk about what we're going to do at home, and then around the world we're militarizing everything. We're killing people. What we do is what we don't want the gangs to do. What we complain about gangs doing, we do it on an international level. That's why it's hard to tell gang members not to do what they're doing, because they look at Bush, they look at the government, they look at that. We go to war as soon as we can. We will conquer people. We get our revenge. I mean, 3,000 people were killed in those World Trade Center bombings. That's a terrible tragedy. But what do? We killed minimum of 3,000 the first time we attacked Afghanistan, just civilians, not even counting all the combatants and everything else. Who knows how many tens of thousands we killed in Iraq. We have a way of doing things that gangs totally can agree with. It's a gang mentality at a high level. For example, those bombings, those smart bombs, what are those? Those are like great drive-bys. You don't have to look in the faces of the people you're shooting at. It's like the same thing when a guy's going in a car and he's shooting at some people. You don't have to know who they are. If they're your enemies, they deserve to die. That's the mentality we have. I think what's really sad is that there was an article in the Rolling Stone magazine where they interviewed some white soldiers who were over there, and they said, one of them said, you know what, Iraq reminds me of Tijuana, it reminds me of Mexico. And he goes, I always wanted to bomb Tijuana. Now I got my chance. This is what this guy said. So you can see that what we learn is that there's us and the rest of the world. For example, when the Twin Towers blew up, it was a human tragedy. it was a tragedy for the whole world to start questioning where we're going, for the whole world to come together, to look at the inequities in the world, to look at the injustices, to see how we can change things so people wouldn't have to go through this again. Instead, our leaders wrapped themselves around the American mat, made this American tragedy, American flag, made this an American tragedy, and then went to war against all these countries. It was an opportunity for us to talk about peace on a global level, and we were not capable of doing it. But this is why I think it's important to challenge that young man, challenge this mentality, challenge the idea that we can go around the world and make it in our image. And also the fact that, in spite of the fact that he might think this is the white man's thing, a lot of people dying in those wars are black and brown people. Sure, a lot of white people are dying, mostly poor whites. A lot of black and brown people. The first time that a black and brown person died for any one of these wars, nobody has a right to question their participation. The problem is I don't agree that they should die for those wars. That's the thing. They died a lot, but that's not right. They shouldn't die for these kind of causes. But still, nobody can question that people put themselves on the line just like anybody else for whatever they thought this country was about.
The other thread I wanted to develop is that you were talking about what is measured as American success being built on the backs of laborers and people who were conquered and displaced, etc. In the introduction to your book, Always Running, you do state that you don't think that a just society can take place until we eliminate the inequities of capitalism that allow people to profit from other people's labor.
And I think that's where we're at, because basically, why do we have to have a society in which some people are going to be exploited at the expense of others, or going to benefit at the expense of others? As long as we have inequitable societies, we're going to have war, conflict, terrorism, if you want to call it. I'm not agreeing with the terrorists. I think their tactics are totally abhorrent. But in other words, they aren't any more terrorists than we can be as a legitimate, country. What we're doing is just as much terrorism, in my view. And when you can bomb indiscriminately whole communities and babies die, you don't think twice about it. When I remember one time when Reagan was bombing Lebanon, Beirut, and he had these gunships outside in the ocean, in the Mediterranean. They were throwing those bombs in there, and whole apartment buildings were being destroyed. And they interviewed, I don't know where I was interviewed, they interviewed one of the Lebanese guys, and he says, "I will never forget what Reagan did." Now that guy was made, quote, and he says, "I will kill his family." I mean, he was quoting the guy. But did he start off that way? No. When that apartment building got destroyed and his whole family was destroyed, his answer was, "I'm going to destroy the people that killed me." Now, he doesn't have the means that the United States has, but look what they can do, some people. So we have to look at our end of it. You know what I'm saying? We have to look at how we contribute, not to justify anybody else's way of doing things, but to realize that we, in fact, do similar things, only we do it under the cloak of legitimacy. We do it under the cloak of whatever we think. And to me, capitalism is very much a part of that. Capitalism is a system that has to keep moving, has to keep feeding, has to destroy in order to build, has to the gap between poor and rich has to keep growing. It's a system that's just built in inequity. And therefore, you have to think about how do you challenge those things, because we're getting caught in that wheel and we can't even let go, and we just keep going and going and going. And you know what? You're not going to resolve these issues unless you look at the root of those problems.
On that note, do you have a poem that deals with the war?
I thought I would share maybe a couple poems from what I wrote from the Poets Against the War that came out. And I wrote several, and I call this Nightfall, Poems to Ponder in Times of War and Uncertainty. And I'll just read a couple. When prisons become the fastest growth industry, our minds and hearts become the imprisoned. When the past of blood and conquest is denied, the land gives back this blood in torrents. When war is the only imagination of the people's imagination becomes an insurrection. When we sacrifice lives, including our children's, evil becomes as common as breathing. When truth scares us to apathy, our only truths come from the most fantastic lies. When enemies are whoever our leaders say they are, we won't know an enemy from a rainbow. When power and wealth drive social policy, all policies are subject to poetic death. When my son asks, "Do I have to go to war?" a father's duty is to war against war first. When people say peace is the absence of conflict, they have no idea what they're talking about. When war forces us to die outside of ourselves, we have to learn to live from inside our bones. And then just let me add this one other one. Our leaders have called in the troops with one or two syllable declarations. Imagination is a casualty of this war, as our poetic language and moral consistency. Despite millions taken to the streets against war, we go to war anyway because, hey, we got the weapons. This is a democracy that doesn't care that people care. This is a country that fights evil with guns, although this is evil's playground, that opposes affirmative action in college, but it pushes affirmative action in the military, that has no vision, although there's plenty to see, that has no dreams, although there's plenty of sleeping, that denies reality, although there's plenty of reality shows.